So my idea of topping off my drink before we started basically amounted to just adding more vodka and a piece of ice.
Excellent.
That's good enough. Hey.
Okay. I'm ready when you are.
Ready? And 3, 2, 1. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Good evening. Good morning. I don't know. I guess I don't know when anybody's listening to us.
Good afternoon.
I guess the stats say as soon as we post this, everybody listens to it. So I'll
experiment.
I'll take that. Hey, hi, everybody. This is the Drunken UX podcast. I am your host, Michael Feenan.
I'm your co-host, Aaron Hill.
Co-host. No, you're the other host.
The other host. The other. I'm like pork. I'm the other white meat.
I want to make a joke about that, but that would just be mean. I can't do that to you. I want to let everybody know that the Drunken UX podcast is brought to you by Gasmark 8. You can check them out at gasmark8.com/drunk. If you like what we're doing, give them a shout out. Let them know that you appreciate their support of us, because we appreciate their support of us. And all that good stuff. So, yeah. I'm
also, what?
What?
What? What the what?
No, would you do something already?
I gotta remember everybody, Mike.
Don't remember everybody. Oh my gosh. Just remember us.
I was gonna say remind. Jesus, this is only my first drink tonight. Don't forget to check us out at drunkenux.com. And you can join us on Slack at drunkenux.com/Slack. Also on Twitter and Facebook at drunkenux. Remember us there.
Yeah, we need to like cram all that into like a smaller thing. I don't know how yet, but it's like it's the same thing everywhere. We're just Drunken UX. You can find us, I swear. We are not that hard to track down. Also, you run by the side after this. Let us know. We're going to be talking about our first websites tonight and how ashamed of them we are. So if you have any fond or otherwise memories of your stuff, also, be sure to run by our website, and you can comment there. We'd love to hear your stories. So, today, this evening, this morning, let's be fair, it is this evening as we are recording this, so I don't feel bad about drinking in the evening. I'm going a little bit old school with just some Tito's vodka and sweet tea, and I want to give a shout-out to Tito's. This is a little shameless, but I don't care.
Right.
I am lucky enough to have partnered up with Imgur and Tito's Vodka. They've started a program called Project Stardust. This is an awesome gig that they are putting together where every quarter they're going to award an Imgurian a $5,000 grant, basically, to go out and do great stuff in their community. And
oh. I heard about somebody doing that in Kansas.
Yeah. If only there was somebody we knew who was involved in this that thought, hey, Tito's is a cool company. I'm going to drink their vodka from now on. I feel like I'm shilling. I'm really not. I actually had never had Tito's vodka before a couple weeks ago. And
yeah,
it's a pretty good vodka. I do give them
it
credit.
It really is. Yeah.
But at any rate, I was lucky enough to be asked to be involved in this because of some charitable work I do every year. And it's going to mean great things for the community. I bring it up mainly to say if you use Imgur and you're a charitable person and you're actively involved in your community, be watching for more information on Project Stardust. We will be sharing a lot more there once some other stuff happens that's in the works. And other people will then be able to apply, and you'll be able to go and try to get money for your community as well. So that's sort of the plug slash I'm patting myself on the back a little bit, I guess, maybe. But I thought it was awesome. I thought it was, you know, an incredible thing. And it was, you know, totally unsolicited on my part. They wanted to do this, and I thought that's just fucking cool. So
yeah,
here's to you, Tito's. Appreciate you guys.
I've got a Svedka who is not doing anything cool with Imgur, as far as I know. But they make good vodka. And it's mixed with a weird iced tea I got from a gas station while driving home. And some orange juice. I just like pour shit into a glass.
Yeah. So man, I don't know. That sounds a little bit
There's probably a name for it, but I think the name is like represented by a prime number or something. Like it's not a cute name. It's just a no.
Svedka's, it's Polish vodka, isn't it?
Swedish.
Okay. Well,
yeah.
Northern European. Yeah.
Yes.
It's funny to me because right, the best vodka is, you know, it's basically a neutral spirit. It's not really supposed mm-hmm. to taste like anything. The better it is, the less it should taste like anything. But like with right. this Tito's, I find it has like almost a kind of sweetness to it.
Huh.
Not necessarily a flavor, but just a sweetness. And I actually found it very pleasant, whereas I like Stoli as well. But Stoli mm-hmm. has kind of a very alcohol-y
mm-hmm.
timber to it, shall we say.
Yeah. You should give Svedka a try. You might like it's a lot smoother than Absolut and Stoli.
I used to be a vodka guy, then I became a scotch guy, and I forget how nice vodka is because you can mix it with anything.
And it also doesn't, like, break your bank buying a bottle of it.
Yeah, also true. Yeah, yeah. So, but we're both iced tea and vodka guys tonight, so twinsies.
Woo!
Starting out this evening, so the news just broke, and of course you guys will be hearing this in a few days, so you will maybe already know about this, but Flickr has been bought by SmugMug.
Oh, again.
Again. in all fairness, Flickr did have a fairly long run at Yahoo, not necessarily a glorious one, but they have been bounced around quite a bit, and I'm hopeful that the SmugMug acquisition sticks, right?
Yeah.
Like I want Flickr to have a home. And
do you think that SmugMug will allow Flickr to remain Flickr, or are they going to like assimilate like the Borg?
SmugMug itself has absolutely said Flickr is Flickr. It's not okay. going anywhere. It's not going to change. They're keeping they appreciate and respect the community that's there, and they see cool. it as a very different service from their normal offering.
So they're kind of just being stewards of the brand and taking it over from Yahoo?
That kind of sounds like it.
Yeah. That's cool.
I do photography. It's a hobby of mine. Let's say I am what's the phrase I'm looking for? I'm a prosumer. An enthusiast, is that maybe the way to put it? I don't get paid to do it, but I do spend a lot of money to do it. I have good gear. I've spent money on lenses, I've got tripods, I've got fancy lights, I like to have that equipment. So I do my fair share, and I have used Flickr I think since about 2006, 2005, mm-hmm. and I've been a pro user that whole time as well. So I've watched, especially as Flickr has moved between owners, I've watched really closely because I'm always worried that my $25 a year, completely unlimited, like,
mm-hmm.
you get everything plan, I keep worrying that they're going to take that away from me.
I used to use it a lot. I started around the same time you did. I did pro a few years just for the additional, having access to the additional photos, but I forget why I stopped using it. It was around the time when Yahoo took it over. Yeah. It was just, I think my priorities changed.
So
what I was doing.
If people don't know, like Flickr has bounced around. So Flickr was founded in 2004. They were their own company for about 2 years, give or take. I think it was around 2006. Yahoo came in, Yahoo bought them. Was not happy about it then. And most people weren't for good reason. Yahoo didn't really do a lot with it. And at times put it, I think, in dire jeopardy as a service.
Yeah.
A few years back, what was it, about 2013, I think it was, Verizon came along. Well, Verizon bought Yahoo. So they didn't just buy Flickr. They spent $4.5 billion or something like that. They bought Yahoo. And so Flickr became a Verizon property at that point. Again, nobody really knew what that meant. Then Verizon, I forget now how this went. AOL bought Flickr from Verizon, who then rolled it into another platform called Oath. Is that the way that worked, or did Verizon buy AOL? Now I can't remember. Hold on. Let's
I'm amazed that AOL is around enough that it's able to buy anything.
Yeah,
I thought it was just existing.
So, Verizon acquired AOL, and then rolled all of that together into this group called Oath.
Mm-hmm. Huh.
And if you think about kind of like how Google sort of spun off Alphabet, who owned Google, or who owns Google.
Oh, right.
It kind of maybe, it was sort of a reverse thing like that. I don't want to get maybe stuck in the details of the business transaction necessarily. So up until the last couple of years, this group called Oath had all of AOL's stuff and Flickr as part of that. And still, not much happening. You know, during all of this time, there was a lot of concern, like Instagram, you know, was a little up and comer at that point, mm-hmm. and everybody was going to Instagram, and then Facebook buys Instagram, and people thought, you know, this is the future of photo sharing, and that's what Flickr's strength is. Flickr's strength is in their community component.
Yeah.
And they thought Instagram was going to crush them, and they were for a while, especially in the mobile area, because Instagram was a mobile app, and Flickr's mobile app was just disgusting. It was terrible.
Yeah, it was pretty awful.
But here's the thing. Flickr isn't Instagram. They service two very different purposes. Just because they both deal with images doesn't make them at all the same, in my opinion.
Does Flickr chronologically order the stream, or does it use an algorithm?
Oh, no. Well, no, I should rephrase. Your photo stream is very much chronological. Now,
then it is strictly better than Instagram, full stop.
your user photo stream. Now, when you log in and you see like your social feed of all the people you follow, I honestly don't know. I don't know if there's an algorithm to that or not at this point. I honestly would be surprised if there is, if only because of how little they have evolved some of that. But here's the thing, and this is why I think Smug Mug buying Flickr is good. Smug Mug is older than Flickr.
Mm-hmm. Really?
Yeah. A lot of people don't realize that. Smug Mug, I believe, was founded in 2003.
When was MySpace? When did that come around?
Oh, God.
Was that 2002?
Hold on. Let's see here. So Smug Mug, no. Now, Smug Mug launched in 2002. MySpace launch date. Listen to my keyboard. 2003. So just right there at that same time. The bad part is I did actually look up these dates before the episode, and I didn't write them down, and I forgot them. LinkedIn was also 2003, for what it's worth. So they were part of this sort of initial birth of social media, you know, the birth of Web 2.0. A couple other sites. Facebook, 2004, same year. Mm-hmm. And another site, just to give you an idea of where we are today, Dig.
Dig was in the news recently. They got acquired by an ad company.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Yeah.
Dig has not been Dig for years. Kind of like
got
MySpace.
Rebuilt at one point. Yeah. Yeah. If you liked Dig the original, just go back to Reddit.
I think that matters to me because Flickr has not changed. Yeah, it doesn't look like it did in 2004. That's obviously. But it also never felt the need to, like, re-envision itself. Like, where it is today is almost a perfect embodiment of that idea that you should never redesign a website.
Right.
You should always just be constantly incrementing so that a year from now, you are different than you were, as opposed to going 3 years and changing everything.
I think they've also never put ads on it, have they?
Oh, no, there are ads. That's part of what my special $25 a year pro plan gets rid of.
Oh, interesting.
But they aren't intrusive. They aren't like DeviantArt. That's what I'm thinking of.
Oh, yeah.
Like, it's not DeviantArt level intrusive. They were never bad, but The thing about Flickr is it's kind of like a cockroach, I think. and not in a bad way. I only mean that as a metaphor for the fact that Flickr does not know how to die. Flickr should have died 3 deaths already, and it's right. still here. Do you remember 500 pics?
Yes. 500
px?
Yeah, it was like a sharing site, right?
It's still out there. It's still, you know, it has become the Vimeo of the photo world. It is
okay.
It is as Vimeo is to YouTube, 500 pics is to Flickr. But 500 pics was the Flickr killer when it launched.
Right.
And I had an account on it for a little while because I thought that was going to be the future at that point. I don't know anybody using 500 pics now.
Mm-hmm.
It's still there. It's, you know, still doing its thing. But between pressure from Instagram, pressure from 500 pics, Yahoo tanking their mobile app and not knowing how to advance the Flickr platform as a whole, Verizon buying it out and spinning it off into Oath, which had no direction, basically, except to just hold on to these properties. Flickr is still here, and it is still heavily used by photographers. And that's why I think it also beats out Instagram. Instagram is for everybody. Instagram is for anybody who takes a picture with their phone. That's not what Flickr is for.
Right.
Flickr is for people to showcase photos.
One thing I really liked about Flickr was that they had a way to you could search based on license.
Yep.
So you could search for things with different kinds of licenses. So if you ever wanted to use a photo of something, you could find a photo and you could use it legitimately with the proper accreditation. Accreditation? I can't English tonight.
No, I'm glad
proper crediting.
I'm really glad you bring that up, though, because I had thought the exact same thing and I forgot to put it in the notes. And
nice.
You pulled it out of your butt, so thank you.
Slam dunk.
No, they were one of, if not the first, to include Creative Commons licensing, which you're absolutely right, is huge. And we use it. We use it for the podcast and finding photos for use on that. That it being able to search whether it's a public domain photo or whether it's something that is allowed to be used just under the license. They were, as far as I know, they were one, even if you went to like creativecommons.org, Flickr mm-hmm. was one of the only services that was like built into their license search.
Yeah. They had a really good API too. I remember using that quite a bit. You know, you could drop in like a PHP library or something and then pull down your photo stream really easily.
So I think I talk a lot about Flickr. I didn't talk much about SmugMug. I don't use SmugMug because I'm not a professional photographer. SmugMug is geared towards people who are trying to sell photos. That's, you know, that is really the target of their market. There's been a lot of commentary about this idea that SmugMug knows how to make money. They've been a paid mm-hmm. service since the day they launched. They understand mm-hmm. how that works, and I think that they have articulated that they understand why Flickr is different from them. So ultimately, if nothing else, we have somebody at the steering wheel who understands imagery. That wasn't Verizon. That wasn't Yoohoo. God,
neither of us
are doing well tonight. That wasn't Yahoo. I think it's good. I think it is ultimately going to be positive for the platform. I think it means the platform has a future, which is good. You know, unlike sites like Delicious. Remember Delicious?
Mm.
And how it bounced around.
I miss that site.
At the end of its
life. That was such a neat. I mean, that wouldn't be at all useful anymore. At the time, though, that was really awesome.
Yeah. We'll include a couple links to articles in the show notes about the Flickr SmugMug acquisition. And let us know what you think. If you're a photographer or, you know, you put out imagery for people to use, let us know. I'll be interested to hear other folks' thoughts on it. Are you encouraged by it? Do you think it's bad? Everybody seems really, one of the threads I've seen going around is everybody really, really wants SmugMug to rip like Yahoo login out of Flickr. They don't want Yahoo logins and all
great.
That. It's funny the way that's going. As of this evening, I was trying to check Flickr right before we started recording tonight's episode. And I did notice that I'm getting an SSL certificate revocation error. So I can't.
And I am not.
Yeah, Aaron's not, but I'm getting it on, and I'm betting it's a DNS thing because I think they've moved the Flickr servers off of Yahoo now on the Smug Mugs infrastructure. They were talking about moving it to AWS, and I'll bet my DNS is updated, yours isn't. I can't even look at it, though, right now.
Who's your upstream provider?
Well, my ISP is Cox. I use Google DNS, though, so...
Oh, okay.
They should be on top of it. I don't know.
Yeah.
We'll see in the morning. So, this evening, we are talking about the past. A little bit about the future, too. A couple weeks ago, episode 7, we got into talking about learning resources and how you get a career in web development. And so, kind of riding on the coattails of that, I thought it would be interesting to talk about not so much how we got into the industry, but how we got into it.
Yeah.
As it were. You know, talk about what web development used to be like for folks that don't realize what, you know, what it was like to get into building websites in the 90s and real early 2000s. But also, you know, not just to go down, I don't want to just go down this road of nostalgia for the sake of it. We'll talk about how that compares to today as well in terms of some of the technology we use and the tools we're using and what that might look like in 20 years.
Yeah. When I got into it, it was a full 10 years before I made it, before I was getting paid as a job for it.
Yeah.
But I mean, like, that kind of experience today with the resources that are available, it would be more like 1 or 2 years.
And actually, that it's funny that you mentioned that, because now that I do the math in my head, it was exactly a decade from when I started building websites to when I started getting paid to build websites.
Yep.
I don't know what to do with that information, but it's interesting. I do.
Faster now.
And I want to encourage our listeners too, because I know a lot of you. I hope you have fun listening to this episode. But the thing I really want to encourage you to do is look for the kids in your life, the 15-year-olds, the 16-year-olds, folks at the end of middle school, going into high school, who enjoy computers and like, you know, the web, not like Facebook and YouTube, like they like the web, and hand them a link to this episode so they can hear what it used to be like and what to think about, you know, as they move forward. Because I think that's going to be the real value in what we talk about tonight.
Fair point, though. We do curse in this show a little bit.
We do curse in the show. And I will as the night goes on. That's okay.
Just FYI.
They've heard it, I think, by this point.
Right.
So for me,
1996,
that was my year. What was your year, Aaron?
Like, the first time I ever wrote any HTML, I want to say it was 95.
Oh, you did beat me.
Only by a little bit. I mean, I had our ISP gave us, like, I think 2 megabytes of space.
Yep.
And I would do HTML, and, like, we had to write it by hand. There was a GUI editor, but it wasn't, like, a WYSIWYG editor, like, the what you see is what you get, like, everything now. It was
a web page with buttons. A giant text box.
No, it was like a desktop app for Windows 3.1, and it just had a bunch of buttons, and the buttons were just tags, so you would like type stuff and then hit the open tag and the close. I mean, you could also just type it manually, so it really wasn't. I think it was called Hot Metal, and it was a silly app, and it's probably long gone. But
to give people some context too, like 1996 for me, that's 2 years before Google even exists.
Yeah.
You know, you were searching on, what was it basically, Lycos?
AltaVista. Oh, Excite, Lycos. Yeah.
AltaVista. I think Yahoo was around at that point. Yahoo was...
Was big.
What was 94, I think?
No, Yahoo was the biggest at the time. They were... I just listened to I'm Feeling Lucky by Douglas Edwards. He was employee number 59 at Google. And they talked about the rise and fall, or the rise, rather, of Google.
I need to listen to that audiobook.
Yahoo and AOL. Yes, I have to get that to you.
Yahoo 94 was officially a company in 95, it looks like. They had, we're going to get stuck in nostalgia, it doesn't matter. I remember going to the Yahoo homepage, and it wasn't about like lexical search. It wasn't about typing in words and getting matches. It was about looking something up in the yellow pages.
Yes, yeah, exactly.
Everything was, like, categorized, and you just went through into the category you wanted, and you got an index. It was a portal. Yeah.
So, funny you should mention Yellow Pages. I owned a copy of the Internet Yellow Pages, which was a physical book. It was about 3 inches thick, like actual Yellow Pages, and it was full of Yellow Page-style ads for websites. You just type in the URL, and it was indexed on the front and back. And at the time, I would say it was reasonably comprehensive with what was available on the internet.
Well, and it made sense because in the mid-90s, we didn't think much about the number of websites there would be today. You know, it was right. conceivable that we could put out a paper directory that would have all the websites right. in them. Like, that was,
yeah.
that didn't seem unreasonable then.
Right. Yeah.
For us, you know, that was how we learned too. So we talk about, mm-hmm. I just for the context of, we talked in episode 7 about all the tools out there and going, you know, to all these learning resources and the stuff you can find. A lot of people go to YouTube, watch videos, all this. None of that existed for us. And we couldn't even necessarily go get books or something like that because right. nobody was writing them at this point.
There was an O'Reilly HTML book, and it was in the late 90s that it was published, right around when Frames came out with the HTML 2.0 standard.
That would be right about right. I think I started around HTML 3.2. HTML 3.2 release date.
Really? No, you must have started sooner than that. 2.0 was when Frames came out, I think.
Well, that may be true, but it looks like, yeah, HTML 3.2 came out in 1996, May 7th.
Oh, no shit. Okay.
So, yeah, that would be right, at least for me. So there you go. Yeah, built. Okay. It is based upon HTML 2.0 and draws from such sources as HTML Plus and HTML 3.0 drafts by Dave Raggett of Hewlett Packard Laboratories. So there you go.
Quick shout out to Tim Berners-Lee. Thanks, man.
In case you wonder if we Google stuff during our show. Yes,
we do.
Yes, we do. So a lot of our learning came from, I did two things very specifically. One, I looked at the source. I looked at a lot of source code, and I used chat.
Yeah. Did you use IRC or ICQ or AIM? Or
I eventually did. When I first started working on stuff, it was me going to a library and using the computer at the library and signing up for my hour slot where I would tie up that phone line and I would do that.
Oh, right, the phone lines.
Now, once we got our first computer in 1998, if I remember right.
Yeah.
And then that was when, like, the world of IRC opened up to me. I can install my own chat tool and use it.
Yeah.
And that was like a whole other world at that point.
Here's a fun piece of trivia. I can type about 100 to 110 words per minute. But the way I learned to type was by using IRC, because the screen, I was in a chat room with some friends, and there was typically 20 to 30 people in there at any given time. And the text would scroll by so fast that to get a word in edgewise, I had to learn to type fast. And so the whole reason that I can type at all properly is because of IRC.
So there you go. That's, you think social media started with MySpace? No. No, that is not how it started. Now, we were talking about this before the show and talking about our first websites, and I mentioned how I had a site on GeoCities. GeoCities was one of the early web providers where you could go and
GeoCities
sign up.
Was great.
They gave you free space and you could basically do anything with it. And as I thought about this and I looked at archive.org, I was wrong. I started out on AngelFire.
Really?
The version of my site that I found on Archive made me realize that there were two versions before that. One of those was on GeoCities, but the other one had to have been on AngelFire because it was not after. When I left GeoCities, that's when I started doing my own, you know, I bought hosting and went that way. So somewhere, I don't remember the address, I can't find it if I had to, but somewhere out there, there may be a snapshot of this ancient site from AngelFire that I wrote. and it was a Star Trek site.
Oh, that's so cool.
I was a total Star Trek nerd in middle school and high school. I still am. I love Star Trek. And I was frustrated by the number of sites I had to go to find the things I was interested in. And so I thought, like all kids think, I can do better than them. And so I set out. That was my inspiration for going out and building my first website, was I can make something as good as the things that I am seeing. And so I tested myself, and that was like how my door opened up.
I didn't have such a story myself. I just put crap up on the internet that I liked, and it was like LiveJournal, but it wasn't LiveJournal. It was just the rantings of a late teen, early 20 something. Hats off to anybody that can find my old sites. I don't think you'll be able to if I don't disclose it, and I'm not going to. So I did just find an archive, though.
I am going to include a link to my, third site, basically.
Yeah.
I'm going to include that in the show notes. Everybody else can shame Aaron. Ask Aaron. This week's Ask Aaron site is to ask him to share his first website.
Oh my god, I'll redact all the text.
But in that sense, a lot of folks did get started that way, though, just making a page and throwing stuff up. Mark Zuckerberg, 1999, had a site on Angel Fire that people found.
That is so awesome.
We're going to link an article from Gizmodo in the show notes about this, that it was basically a little web page of him showing off some of his tools that he played with, and some of his favorite sites and all of this, and it's hilarious. The site itself is no longer up. I looked and tried to find it. It has officially been taken down.
That is some very 1999 stuff right there.
They have screenshots.
Yeah.
So
wow. Oh, he had some cool stuff on it.
And yeah, I mean, yeah, it makes sense, though, and I think it's important to look at that stuff, because especially when you're making your first sites and you're a kid, basically, you aren't an adult at that point. Well, you are going to just do what you think is cool and what you have fun with. And for me, it was as much about the sense of accomplishment that I built something.
Yeah.
And you look at all these toys today that we're talking about, and not getting into like the Arduino stuff and all of that, but certainly the Lego. What's mine?
Minecraft.
No. The Lego thing. Where you build robots. I don't know. We didn't have it when I was a kid.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about. Yeah. It's like a mixture of like an Erector set with Legos, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And it's got the little programmable thing here. Lego. Uh-huh. I may be wrong. Mindstorm? Is that what it is? No.
That sounds right.
Oh, yeah. Mindstorm. There we go. I was right.
Yeah. Oh yeah,
but no, and you're absolutely on the mark though. Minecraft, my buddy's got three kids, and they're young. I mean, I think his oldest is six.
Both my kids do stuff with redstone, and I'm just like, I can do little things with redstone, but like my son is a freaking wizard with it. It's amazing what he can do.
I can't look at a kid and tell if they're like three or eight.
They're basically this. I mean, you know, small differences.
So
but
all of them are six to me. I just kind of split the difference. Right. But no, they not only like they watch these Minecraft videos certainly on YouTube, but now they are at the point where they play it. They have have a tablet and a touchscreen computer and all this. So they are playing Minecraft. But it is a very similar thinking. You know, this idea of hey, I can go build something, and then I can see this thing I built. And I'm not making it for anybody else. I'm not making it because I want, you know, the world to see it. I'm making it because I want to know that I can do it.
Yeah, definitely. I would say that's very much the Minecraft thing.
HTML is like the ultimate, I want to just build something playground.
Yeah.
And nobody can tell you what those limitations are, really.
You can tell when someone learned HTML a long time ago and hasn't kept their skills updated if they do all of their tags in all caps.
Oh, yeah.
Because I don't think it was ever required to be all caps, but everyone, myself included, did all of our HTML in all caps. And That's a hard habit to break.
So just to, and this is sort of more for context than anything, but you know, everything at this point was basically done with FTP. GeoCities, when they started really pushing their service, they finally added the page. It was a page with a text box and a submit button. And the text box just, you vomited HTML into it, but it saved it. It was, I call it, it was an FTP wrapper, basically. Like a, GeoCities was kind of a container that wrapped around FTP because it didn't do anything else.
When you made an account with them, though, they would give you the FTP info and you would connect to it with FTP and upload it.
Yeah, you could connect. And even after they introduced the web interface, you could still use your FTP connection.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't have databases. That just wasn't a thing. It's not that they didn't offer it. That just wasn't something we had. We had JavaScript, but it was rudimentary to the point that nobody really used it.
JavaScript was like, it was the tool that you used to make, to animate things on your page or have mouse responses or to do things like type your name in here and then click this button and then it says something mean about you using your name.
Pop-ups.
Oh, pop-ups too.
Alerts. There was a lot done with alerts at that point. So obviously no jQuery, no DOM manipulation, nothing like that existed. CSS, not even a thing.
Didn't exist.
You did everything in attributes. BG color.
There was a 3 year or 2 or 3 year period where there was kind of a gap in me doing anything with like web stuff. And that was when CSS came out. And when I started getting back into web, I was like, the fuck is cascading style sheets? I was still doing table-based layouts back then.
If you needed to do anything complicated, you know, now, of course, PHP is kind of the standard for any of that. But again, didn't exist at that point.
Right.
Or at least it wasn't available. How long is here? Here we go. Here's next Google. When did PHP launch? Let's see. Hold on. What is it? 1994. So it did exist.
94.
It did exist.
Interesting.
But it certainly was not being offered at that point. I'm sorry, 95.
No, not by hosts. First appeared
1995, according to the wiki.
That's OG.
Yeah, 23 years ago. Old enough to vote and drink. But everything, you could do applications if you were willing to jump into Perl. I didn't.
Yeah, any application or anything you'd post back would always have a CGI-bin in the URL.
Yeah.
You couldn't get it through GeoCities or any of those other things. And like my ISP didn't offer CGI. So like doing anything that was involved posting back to the server was not really as feasible as it is now.
It was the read-only web.
Yeah.
That's what it was. It was the read-only web.
Yeah.
And I eventually did get, I used a platform that used CGI, and I always remember that it was the tool that I will forever remember as being the thing that broke constantly and never told me why. Because didn't have access to server logs. I didn't have access to any kind of debugging stuff. It would just like 500 error. And all I could find would be to do something like reinstall it. There was no two ways about it. So that's what the world was like, though. And I think in kind of ending on that piece of it, it was the read-only web. We put stuff out and people came to it.
One last thing, just for context of how different things were. My friend of mine in high school, this was before Napster, but after MP3s came out. So before MP3s, my friends and I would trade music on like from cassette tapes and stuff over IRC as WAV files. But they're massive. You know, 10 megabytes per minute. So like a song was typically 50 megs, which is a lot when your storage is like maybe 400 megabytes on your hard drive.
And you're on a 33.6 baud mode, KBOD mode.
If you're lucky. but MP3s, it was like, it would reduce it down to about 1 meg per minute. And so my friend in high school and I, we would put MP3s up like onto a GeoCities site. And that was totally legal to do then.
Well, whether or not it was legal was questionable.
It wasn't illegal.
No, nobody was thinking about it. That
is gray area.
Is fancy because I remember MIDIs.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You remember people yep. making MIDI versions of songs?
Put it on their website.
And going out and finding who has made the best MIDI version of Alanis Morissette, Ironic. So we talked in episode 7 about, you know, one of the things, if you are interested in web development, you should learn the Holy Trinity. Mm. Holy Trinity being HTML, CSS, JavaScript, the foundations of a website. I was thinking about it. That didn't exist for us.
Yeah.
HTML was all of the things. Design was not different from layout and code and programming yeah. for that kind of, like, it was all one thing.
Right.
And that's not to say it was good, bad, more or less work. It's just to say it required a very different way of thinking.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, if you wanted, you could do semantic HTML, right, where you just do the top to bottom, and like a lot of like really old websites or people who have not bothered updating their skills since then still do that. But the people who are like, you know, want to have a nice brand or something, they'll take an image in Photoshop and slice it up and then put them as table cell background images. Yeah. So you had table based layouts. That was real hot in the late 90s.
And that was the first time that we, I think, started thinking about web design as a different yeah. discipline from web development.
Yes.
We did exactly that. The very first, so the first website I made isn't necessarily the first website I did. If that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, I made sites, but the first website I built to be like, I'm going to make a thing and mm-hmm. have it be a thing. It had its own domain name. It existed as a self-contained entity. It was a site called supersatellite.com, named after the Our Lady Peace song. And it was it was all about local entertainment. So we would go out, we would write movie reviews, we would go out and do concert reviews, things like that. Actually, for our area, an incredibly successful site when we put it out.
Cool.
But it was also the first site that I did what you just described. My idea of design was going into Photoshop, building how I wanted it to look, and then mm-hmm. figuring out how to carve that up and put it yes. onto the web page.
You drag the guides into it, carve it up into cells, and you do the snap to guide and you use your select tool, and then
yep.
pop them out.
And that was the start of that, because before that, everything up to that, the closest thing we got to design, for me anyway, and I'm disappointed, so I mentioned I'll have a link to the archive.org snapshot of my old site, but my navigation was because mm-hmm. like I said, I was a Star Trek nerd.
Yeah.
It was a Lacar's interface that I designed. I did it myself I don't even know what I was using at that point in time. It must have been Paint, I guess.
Yeah.
But I do remember, and I would, like, if I looked at it and I said 16-year-old me built that, I'd be like,
"Yeah,
fuck yeah, you go, 16-year-old Michael. That's awesome." Like, it looked good, and yeah. it was an image map.
Nice.
And so talk about, you know, carving things up into cells. Remember going in and trying to pinpoint the pixel dimensions for your hitboxes?
I had a tool for that. Yeah, there was a tool that you could do that with.
Oh, I did it manually. I did it the hard way.
Glutton for punishment.
But I say I'm disappointed because the snapshot, for whatever reason, it saved almost my entire site except that.
Oh.
The image map isn't there. And that, if any, I'm genuinely sad about that.
We had to use, so like you can use the hover pseudo class now in CSS, but if you wanted to have like mouse interactions where if you hover over something it lights it up, you'd have to use on mouse over.
We're only about 25 minutes in, man. 30 minutes in. Come on, get it together, dude.
And then on mouse out when you move the mouse off of it, which worked pretty well. You would have problems sometimes because of JavaScript.
Eventually, so we started this whole thing. You know, everything was either FTP or you mm-hmm. went to a web page and saved it through that. But it was just raw HTML files, basically. Images as best you could do. I do remember remember VRML?
Mm-hmm.
That was sort of the first kind of interactive Java applet 3D kind of thing.
Oh, and everybody confused Java and JavaScript.
Oh, yeah. That was, well, that was their own fault. They should have known better. We had Java, JavaScript, VRML, DHTML was kind of a thing. Trying to make fetch a thing. That's what DHTML was. It's like, if DHTML is not going to be a thing, stop trying to make it a thing. But that was when JavaScript, people kind of realized, hey, you can start using JavaScript to do cool things.
Yeah. We didn't know any better. Sorry.
But it's all extremely important because it's how we got here.
Oh, and navigation had to be manually reproduced on every page unless you knew how to do either server-side includes and your web server was Apache-based, or you were lucky enough to come in late and have access to PHP.
So here's the fun part about that. Of course, WordPress was not a thing. That just didn't exist. By the time roughly 2000 hit, 2000 is when you can honestly say people were able to get into the web development game and do so in a way that was meaningful to a career. Doing it in the 90s was all about learning, you know, figuring out what we could do.
Nobody knew what the fuck they were doing in the 90s. Like, even, like, you know, Coca-Cola and anyone else, like, they're like, what? The internet?
Yeah.
That's what'll be gone.
it's like we said earlier, that this idea that there were no standards, there was no discipline behind it. It was just the web. You know, you were the webmaster. That was your role.
Do you ever watch *Halt and Catch Fire*? It's on Netflix.
I can honestly say I have no clue what you're talking about.
It's a cool show. Each season is like a different epoch in the world of IT. The first one is like the first personal computers. The second one is like BBSs. The third season is, I forget. But the fourth season, the most recent one, they're getting involved in the search engine / portal world. And it's right as like Yahoo is starting to pick up steam. But it's like, if you want to know, if you're curious and you want to know what the web was like in the mid to late 90s, that season is spot on.
Now I feel bad that I haven't seen it because it sounds like it's right
up my
alley.
Oh, dude, it's totally, it's great. It's great.
I'll have to check that out. Say the name again for the listeners.
Halt and Catch Fire.
Halt and Catch
it's
Fire.
It's on Netflix. And the music, if you use Spotify, the Halt and Catch Fire team puts together playlists from the show that are like for each season, and the playlists are fucking awesome. Oh, so much good stuff.
Is it a Netflix original?
No, it's AMC, I think.
Oh, interesting. Okay.
Yeah. I think you'd like it. It's a cool show.
So, to talk about brands, though, the classic adage, have you been to spacejam.com?
Is that still up? Oh, my God.
It is both still up and still exactly as it was in 1996.
That's amazing.
I don't know that it was the first movie website that anybody ever put out, but it's definitely the only one that's still out there and still looks the same.
That is... Kudos to Warner Brothers for keeping that up. That is amazing.
Yeah, it does redirect to Warner Brothers' website now, but they have kept it exactly as it is. And, you know, at this point, you know, they keep it because of the joke, basically.
It even uses frames.
But talking about brands trying to figure out, how do we use this new thing? What on earth do we do with this website? You know, Space Jam kind of put it out there and said, let's go nuts. Let's try to figure out what we can do with it.
This made me remember the navigation thing I mentioned earlier. The other method to do was frames.
Yeah.
You could put your navigation into a top frame and then have it target the main content area.
And
that way it wouldn't have to...
I forget now, when did frames come out?
HTML2.
I remember when frames was like, that was the thing. Like, that was just what you were supposed to do. And
Yeah.
Almost immediately, everybody's like, oh, don't use frames.
Yeah. It was.
There was like a 6-month window there where you were really confused.
I think HTML3 is when tables came out, wasn't it? Or were they out?
You're quizzing me on something that now I'm just going to get sad that I don't know.
I don't remember.
So when 2000 hit, bring it back in. Listen, folks, I made a really big glass of Tito's and sweet tea here. So, and it's going to get refilled at the break. When 2000 hit, so the first website I built that was a real genuine website used a CMS. Mm-hmm. Now, this is where I emphasize WordPress didn't exist yet.
What did you use?
So there was a platform that came out. So we were talking earlier about CGI and how important CGI was to any kind of interaction. There was a system called NewsPro. Now, I don't know if NewsPro is still around. I don't think they are because I didn't use them. What I used was a system called Coronto.
Huh.
Coronto was built on top of NewsPro. Like it was a fork of NewsPro, but it was a CGI-based system, no database. Because again, by this point, databases still were not really a service that was being offered by like entry-level web hosting. And so Coronto was all built around a Perl library that would build out flat files. And so it saved like all your template information, all your structured content information into flat files, and then rendered out all of your HTML pages based on what you needed. Huh. So when you made a change,
that's really cool.
You hit up the publish button and then it went through all your pages and would re-render them, which obviously could take some time depending on what you were doing.
But far less than doing it manually. Shit. I wish I would have known about that. That would have saved me so many hours.
Yeah, so I got into that stuff real early in terms of trying to figure out how to work smarter, not harder. Some folks were using front page templates. Remember front page extensions?
Oh, fuck that, man. No.
We support front page extensions.
No. Nope.
That,
no.
You can say no, but it was important then.
Fuck that.
That functionality was really important at that time. And this was kind of just a different way because I was a kid. I couldn't afford Microsoft Front Page. Or here's one. You know, Dreamweaver has been around forever, but remember, it didn't used to be Adobe. It was
Macromedia.
Fireworks. Yep, I remember that. Running your images, not doing images, you know, in Photoshop, doing them in Fireworks.
I could never figure out what to use with Fireworks, but I used Dreamweaver a little bit. The WYSIWYG editor was like, it was all right.
But Coronto still exists today. It hasn't been updated in a decade, but it's still there, and it still
that
works.
That is awesome. And I think it was Netscape 2.0 had a WYSIWYG editor built into it that you could use to edit HTML pages.
I do vaguely remember that. I don't know what version it was, but I do remember Netscape saying, hey, we've released an HTML editor in our product.
Yeah. It had the big white serif N sitting on like a kind of a night horizon. And then 3.0 was the navigator version, which had the ship turny wheel thing. I have no idea what that's called. Sorry.
The ship turny wheel thing.
It's the thing the guy at the top of the ship is. Oh my God. This is embarrassing.
Nah, I'm going to let you be embarrassed. So that was sort of the introduction, though, of me to the CMS. And that's kind of the gateway between my past and present a little bit, because that's when I had a dynamic website then, and I could build a template, and I could do something where I did have server-side includes running, and I did have a site where, I mean, Coronto, the thing I loved about Coronto was, like, it was running structured content before, not just before WordPress existed, but before WordPress even thought about stuff like custom post types and all of that, like years and years before any of that was a thing. That's what I will always kind of remember, and why I've always kind of kept it in my mind when I talk to people about this kind of stuff, because it's like that we've had these tools in some cases for a long time. It's just a matter of what you are comfortable teaching yourself to use. Because I'll tell you, when Coronto broke on me, that was not a fun time. Because I was not comfortable fixing it like I am fixing WordPress.
Before we go to break, I think one really important point from all the stuff we've just been talking about is that, you know, today the tools are very different and you can pick this stuff up a lot faster and there's a far more information that's freely available. But like no matter what, there's no wrong tool to use if you're able to build something and, you know, use whatever you have available to you, even if it's not like what the professionals are. Like, there's zero shame in using Notepad to do your HTML editing.
Oh, yeah, totally. Although,
it's hard. It's hard.
There is Atom now, and it's free, too. So use Atom. Do yourself a favor.
Well, you know, like, sure. I mean, like, yes, you should use the best tools you can access, but, like, you know, don't sweat. Don't let the lack of proper toolage, like, keep you from starting anything at all.
Yeah.
You know, make your Star Trek website. Today, not tomorrow.
Well, when we come back from the break, but guys, it's called Drunken UX for a reason. I'm just saying. I guess we started. I feel like I didn't start early, but given the way we've been talking tonight, that's just the name of the game tonight. So when we come back from the break, we will be talking about the future, and the future is now, and what today's people's nostalgia will be tomorrow. God, I should.
What's the Space Jam site going
to
be?
I should have written something to say there.
The Drunken UX podcast is made possible by our friends at Gasmark 8. Gasmark 8 is a web hosting firm with data centers in New York, San Francisco, London, and Frankfurt. Customers of Gasmark 8 enjoy free SSL certificates, sites that are served over HTTP2, and the experience of owners who designed a service around the needs of their customers. Listeners of the Drunken UX podcast can enjoy service for $10 a month. Just sign up at gasmark8.com/drunk. That's gasmark8.com/drunk.
Hey everybody, hi, how you doing? It's Michael. I'm here with the Drunken UX podcast, and with me on the other side of the microphone is Aaron.
This is Aaron. Yep, I'm also here.
Save me. Hi. Yeah, so thanks for sticking with us and coming back after the break. I almost got him.
Oh. Almost spat my drink out.
Almost got him. Damn it.
Damn it.
So you're listening to the Drunken UX podcast. I am glad that you're with us and going down this little walk down memory lane.
Yeah, I hope this isn't incredibly boring. Like, I know we probably sound like old men talking about when ice cream cost 5 cents, but
here's what I like to think. There are a ton of podcasts out there talking about web development and UX and design and all these things, and they talk about the issues. I like to have fun with it, and I hope they enjoy us having fun with it, so.
I hope so, too.
Hope you guys do, because this is what you're getting.
I tried spitting the marbles out of my mouth, but I don't know if I got them all.
So here's my question, Aaron. I want to know, so we, at least I, and you started on some of your self-hosted. I know a lot of folks start, when they start getting into web development, some of them started with their ISP. ISPs usually gave you like 10 megs, and they felt really generous doing that when literally everybody else was giving you 100 for free. But they felt really good about giving you like, you know, /tilde your last name.
Yeah. Do they still do that?
I think a lot of them do, actually. I think like Cox, I use Cox Communications. Still have marbles in my mouth. I want to say that I actually do have web space with them if I want to use it, which I do not. A lot between their ISPs, but a lot of people also got that through college.
Oh, yeah, that's
universities
right.
were really big about giving students space, and it followed kind of that same generous, format. Yeah. You know, you'd have like a little tilde / your last name.
Yeah.
Is it tilde or tilde? Just depend on where you're from.
In case anybody's curious, if you're not a Unix-y person, the tilde is the it indicates it's your like your home folder. So it's using the user accounts spot. And then it's, Apache has defaults, I think, for that.
GeoCities died in 2009. Yahoo bought them. And much like our opening conversation about Flickr, Yahoo bought lots of things that they didn't really know what to do with. GeoCities happened to be one of those. Yeah. Angel Fire, oddly enough, still around.
That's amazing.
It really is. And if you look at it, it looks like it belongs in about 2004. It's kind of wild. I didn't go through all the steps, but it does look like it is an up and running service at this point where you can host a website.
Where are they hosting? I wonder who's hosting them. I wonder if it's AWS.
That's a thing. Lycos still owns them. Yeah. Lycos is still around. Who knew that was still a thing?
Yeah. I have a friend who has a Lycos email.
I don't know what to make of that stuff, but obviously nobody is really using it at this point.
Right.
You know, that's not the way people tend to host host websites.
So, like, what's the new Tripod, Angel Fire, Zoom, GeoCities for today?
That's the question, isn't it? Because the thing, and the reason that this is a hard question, at least the way I'm looking at it, is what made Angel Fire and GeoCities and their ilk so good was that they were free. Now, yeah. I didn't get my own domain name. Like, it literally, my domain or my address was geocities.com/televisioncity/set/2052. Capitalization mattered in all of that, mind you.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Like, I didn't have my own domain or anything, but I had web space.
Yeah.
But there aren't a lot of places now where you can go to do that, certainly not ones that are considered popular.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think about, of course, you have your Zangas and your Live Journals and your WordPress.coms and your Mediums as of today. Yep. And while those certainly satisfy a need, I don't think they qualify as filling this particular niche. Because niche, so here's niche or niche? Which one do you use?
I used to use
niche. Niche? Maybe niche is a Kansas thing. We do a lot of stupid stuff.
See, creek or crick.
So I'm trying to think about this from the angle of where can I go if I was a kid for free and build a website? And the first thing that came to mind, even though I don't think it's as popular for this purpose, is Google Pages or GitHub Pages. Google did have their version.
Yeah.
Still does for what it's worth, but not nearly as useful. But GitHub definitely is, I think. You can go sign up for an account, upload HTML and JavaScript to it, and have a site.
It's very classic. But I think the thing about the free hosting, though, with all the sites, it was facilitating, it was a very narrow bottleneck that a bunch of different kinds of users all had go through. So, like, whether you were a person like you and I who just wanted to make web pages about a thing, or maybe someone else who would ultimately find their home on LiveJournal or WordPress, because they just wanted to create content and publish on the web. Different kinds of people had different needs. And I completely agree with you that GitHub Pages is the most parallel to what those other ones used to be. But I'm not sure that, like, I'm not sure that isn't just like an unnecessary constraint that we're putting on the question.
The need has changed significantly, I think.
Yeah.
And I don't think you're wrong. Yeah. I think that what I want to encourage people is, especially parents, and the second half of the show, this is for the parents, that this is about encouraging your kids to build things. And if you're using WordPress, if you're using Medium, you are not building anything. You are writing.
Right. Well,
creating content is all equally important. Creating content is also very important, but it is a different deal. And this is also that angle of building a website meant all of the things in the late 90s and early 2000s. It meant I was designing. It meant I was making content. It meant I was writing code. Now, that's way less true. You can kind of do those things separately and still be successful, which is great. I'm not saying that in a negative connotation. But it does change that landscape somewhat, because kids want to build stuff. They want to know that they can take something from idea to touchable, as it were.
If I mean, what's your feelings on some of the like cheap shared hosting services? Like the first domain name that I ever purchased was my same one I use right now. It's amhill.net, and that was hosted on DreamHost. I still actually have my same DreamHost account, but I'm hosting it through digital. My website's hosted through DigitalOcean now. But like I know there's like Bluehost and HostGator, and there's a few others where you just pay like $5-$10 a month, and they even have like one-click installs for whatever platform you want to use. It just does all the heavy lifting for you, and then give you FTP access. And
I think the first host I paid for was, God, I'm sure I'm getting this wrong, but I think it was called ePowerWeb, I think.
Okay.
Because everything had an E on it at that point.
Right.
And the first domain I bought was Super Satellite. That was the first, right. Like I say, that was the first time I tried to make a website to actually be a website.
Right.
Oddly enough, I own Phenon.com. I didn't buy that until a few years ago, actually. Like, it's, I think, maybe 6 or 7 years ago. Luckily, I have a really, really unique last name, so it was not a problem getting it, as it turns out. I've tried to offer relatives, like, their name at Phenon.com, and none of them want it.
Oh, really? That's a
shame.
I don't
know what to make of that. But to answer your question, no, I do think they have a role to play, and I think it is an important role. Just like the way we build websites and the way we think about websites, and the way we would encourage people to, you know, get into websites has changed. So too has the nature of hosting. And while I guess the difference to me is a kid could go start building something on GitHub Pages, they can't start building something on Bluehost because they have to pay for it.
Not as easily.
You have to have your parent, you know, sign you up and put the credit card in. Not that that's a problem. And I'll talk about that, I think, more here in a second, but I do think they have a role to play.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be interesting to me to see a group like that offer, you know, something free to kids.
Yeah.
I don't know what that looks like. I know there's all kinds of legal stuff when you're working with kids, but and there are organizations that are really engaged in fostering development and learning. You know, it comes down to, you know, we think a lot about how things were and now how things are. How hosting has changed over 20 years. We were looking at the developer survey, the Stack Overflow developer survey earlier tonight. We'll have a link to the results in that. Also interesting. I think we talked about it in one of the real-time overview episodes a few weeks ago. But a quarter of developers have 5 years or less of experience at this point.
That's incredible.
And the people that fall into Aaron and I's realm, where we have like 12 years or more, is also about a quarter.
Yeah.
And so we're...
That means half the people have between those two numbers.
So
right?
We're kind of evenly split in terms of that experience level. But what we experienced at those ends of the spectrum, I think, is very different. And so it's interesting to think about this, because it's all learning, it's all building. Because I try to avoid this get-off-my-lawn mentality about web development, and I have it. I have it bad, especially about build processes. And we will have an episode to discuss build processes and build tools, because Webpack, I hate you. You're stupid. You're dumb. You break. I don't know why I have to use you. Whole other story.
We should definitely do an episode about.
Oh,
about
it's that. Happening. That will come. I don't mind a build process, but I do mind a build process that gets in my way. But you know that it. I have to set myself back with that perspective and say, you know what? Yeah, it's new. It's different. Michael, you're older. You need to learn something here, and you will then see that light. We have to do that. And so this is, while this may sound a little maybe repetitive or not helpful, it is, I think, to go through this. Think about what used to be. So we talk about layout.
Mm-hmm.
layout was tables. Tables were never built for layout. Like, tables as a markup format was never intended for layout.
If you are today, if you are still doing tables for layouts, please stop. Please don't do that.
While my instinct is to say that's not a warning you have to give people, I was looking at a product recently. I won't name names because I don't want to do that. But it was a large company, and their entire product spit out nothing but table-based layout. Not just in the product, but like in the thing you built. And I nearly cried. That's a whole other issue. But
in a strange, ironic twist of fate, the React table extension for React spits out, instead of using tables, it spits out divs. Just divs inside of divs to emulate a table. So it's using a div-based table instead of table-based layout.
I would say that's faking it until you make it, but that doesn't seem like the right metaphor. But it is, you know, when we think about that, though, you know, we tables weren't built for that, but we learned really quickly that we could use it that way.
Yeah, Again, using the tools that you have available.
Let me throw a word at you here. Spacer.
I think you should explain for the people keeping score
at home. When you built table-based layouts, you included an invisible... Because GIFs were... They supported transparency. So you would have a 1-pixel by 1-pixel GIF that was invisible. You would stretch it however big you needed because table cells want to collapse. So we would build a table cell, we would put a background image in it, and then we would put the spacer in it to be the size of what we needed to show that image.
You could also use spacer GIFs to do vertical alignment. If you needed something to be 55 pixels from the top of the table cell, you throw in the spacer GIF and you say height equals 55, and then it stretches.
And now you know why we have padding in CSS.
Yeah, and so I only mention that because Flexbox, some of you new kids using the Flexbox out there, I learned about that last year, and you can do vertical alignment with Flex, and I was like, oh my god, for real? Like, it was so exciting to learn that you can finally, after 20 years, you can finally do vertical alignment properly.
And we're already, and so here's the perfect example, right, that we've gone from tables and spacers to now we've started, you know, when floats, you know, CSS floats was like a watershed moment for people, even though floats are maddening to use. And then we had Flexbox, CSS Grid, you know, all the vendor prefixes that come with some of this as they're implementing stuff. But think about how quickly the conversation has pivoted from Flexbox to CSS Grids. In the course of 2 years, like, that conversation has just changed dramatically. Yeah. And there are people that are already like trying to wash their hands of Flexbox to say, no, CSS Grids are the absolute future.
Is CSS Grids the PEM thing?
No. CSS Grid is like, it's an actual CSS component now in 3.0 that it's...
Oh, whoa,
it's,
really?
Yeah, it's basically this idea of being able to tell divs how to behave in alignment within a confined space. Now, I will yield to that discussion because Flexbox has very specific use cases. CSS Grid has very specific use cases, both of which have strengths, weaknesses, whatever.
Yeah.
This is a fight we're having. Imagine what this fight will be looked back on in 15 years, in 20 years. This is the new table layout debate. And this is the kids that are learning this stuff now are going to say, remember when we were using Flexbox? Holy crap. How stupid. Could we have come up with a dumber name than Flexbox?
So I think it's important to know. So I had a client one time, who's a photographer. And this was back in, I think, like mid-2000s, maybe. After I'd run CSS and was getting paid to do web stuff. And she really wanted background music on her website. And to make that happen, I had to use frames because I couldn't do Ajax loading of the content and still have it work right with some of the pieces of content that were in there. And I couldn't have it start the song over and over again every time you change pages because MySpace was already bad with that. So I used the frame, put the music player in, and then that would play it persistently throughout the site. So like, but frames in the mid-2000s. Nobody's using frames anymore, but the technology is still there and you can still use it. So like, so maybe using a spacer GIF might be useful for someone.
Think about what we're using today, you know, between like SAS and preprocessors. Super useful. Mm-hmm. Fantastic utility.
Yeah.
jQuery. There are already a million articles floating around about the death of jQuery. You know, we're already looking back on the way we used to hack around Internet Explorer. Remember, LTE less than 9.
Yes.
You know, how long that persisted for us in terms of the way this stuff changes. And every time we do it, we think that we're being so smart about what we've created and the solution we've built.
Yeah.
And whether or not that's a hack or not, because a lot of the times tables were a total hack, but we thought that was the smartest thing in the world. When people realized, so before we had, Luke Roblowski, there's no way I'm saying this name. Not at this point. Roblowski. Sorry, Luke, man. I'm sorry. Change your name, please. Give me something easier to work with. Before he came out and was all like, you know, here's what responsive web development is, we had tables with percentage-based widths. And it was magical. It was this thing that I don't have to worry if you're using a 640 by 480 or an 800 by 600. I can make my site look good for both of them. We thought we were being so smart with that.
Yeah.
And we look back on that now, you know, 15 years later, and it's like, man... Yeah, okay, it worked, and we did. Well, we were doing the best we could, but we would never
now. Coming back to the point you made a minute ago, like, you know, you're calling them hacks, and, you know, I call them hacks too, and I think it's important to clarify for people that maybe aren't familiar with that term that, like, in this case, we mean hacks by a clever solution using something in a way that perhaps it wasn't intended, or a clever solution, period. And the thing about hacks is that they're great and they work, and they usually work really well at a very narrow use case, but it's still technical debt.
Is there a good German word for that? I feel like there should be.
There should be.
That is dying for a good German word.
It's Gutenberg. That's your German word. I'm just kidding. Just kidding, Jeff. Just kidding.
So here's... And I'm kind of wrapping up, but kind of not. Here's my message. I want this whole episode to be about investing in kids' future. Kids' futures. Yeah. Sorry, plural. you brought up Aaron talking about like Bluehost and HostGator and these folks who do, you know, basic web hosting. I want parents to think about how much do you spend on anything for your kid? Absolutely anything. HostGator, what is it, $4 a month? $3.95, whatever, a month?
Something like, if you're doing low traffic, it's really cheap.
You know, a web host is cheap. Buy your kids an access to a web hosting service, even at a very basic level, for even if it was $10 a month. What do you spend $10 a month for your kid on that is less useful than something like this might be?
It's one trip to Starbucks is the monthly hosting cost for a very basic low traffic.
You know, we were lucky in having access to some of these free hosting services, but and as we said, GitHub Pages is free if that's the route you want to go.
Yeah.
Buy your kid a domain name. At that point, you could use GitHub Pages and point a domain at it. Let the kid figure out how to do that. Google domains. Yeah. Just use Google domains. You'll be fine. But for that cost, listen. So here's where I'm going to get a little weepy and look back on my childhood. You can go out right now, and we have a Facebook buy sell group, right? I'm sure Ithaca has 27 of them.
At least.
At least, right? How big is Ithaca? 200,000?
No, not that big. When college students are here, I want to say it's like maybe 50 or 60. Oh. And then when they're not here, it's half.
Okay. So, well, no, you're much smaller than I thought because Pittsburgh's 20.
Yeah.
We're 20,000. So,
yeah.
But we have several buy sell groups. You can get a laptop for $100. A serviceable laptop. Now, I want to be very clear. I know kids, you know, and this isn't about kids' access to technology and how that changes how they think and all this. I'm not talking about that. I know every kid has a tablet, but you can't learn how to do web development on a tablet. We aren't there. Yeah. We may get there. I have done it. I have a Bluetooth keyboard. I have GitHub access. I can do web development on a tablet, but it is not fun or easy. But you can get a $100 Windows laptop that your kid can use so that, A, if they break it, you don't care. I think that's the important part there. But that is functional and gets the point across. Listen, when we got our first computer, I want to say it was 1998. Because I'd mentioned my first computer experiences, I did two things. I went to the library. And we had a science and technology center, but they only had Apple IIe's and no internet.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that's how far back we're going here. Green screen Star Trek games kind of stuff. And I remember those games. They were fun. My parents, I realized looking back on it, my parents sacrificed a ton to afford this $2,500 machine that ran Windows 95 with a 1.5 gig hard drive and a Pentium 90.
Oh my God.
But that got me from where I would go spend an hour a week at the library to being able to spend an hour a night at home learning this stuff.
Yeah.
And I would not have my career today had my parents not made that sacrifice. And so to all of our listeners who have kids or work with kids or whatever that case may be, this is my screw you moment. You can do this. If my parents at that point, they were self-employed, we were not a rich family, they sacrificed to afford a $2,500 computer on, you know, credit to buy that. You can afford a $5 a month web host.
Yeah.
You can afford a $100 laptop for your kid. And It literally, I am and here
you,
because
and
of
if
that.
You if you can't, like, I mean, you know, $100 can be a lot of money even with a big sacrifice, but we have a reuse center here in town. You can get a very serviceable computer that's been cleaned and updated and everything that was donated by someone. You know, they're like $40.
It's important to me because I think that matters so much because you have access to all these sites. Code.org is an organization completely devoted to helping kids learn how to program. And this goes much farther than web development, but programming of any
sort. There's also MIT Scratch. Both my kids like to
Scratch
use that one.
Scratch is huge, yeah.
Scratch is really cool.
Code Wars. Code Wars is big. Free. All of these are free. Scratch is free. Code.org has a free program. The Khan Academy.
The Khan Academy stuff is amazing.
They have a computer science section.
Yeah.
So this stuff matters so much, and it makes such a difference because, like I say, Mike, I don't know what I would be doing if my parents had not given me that access as a kid and said, you know what, we trust you to build a website. And they were always looking. Maybe about my dad. My dad's kind of afraid of computers. That's okay. But my mom was all, because I was building Star Trek stuff, and my mom's a Star Trek nerd too, so she was super interested in my website. You know, be engaged. You don't have to know how they're doing it or what they're doing, but empowering them to go build something and giving them those resources, it gives your kids so many paths. And when we did it, it was all about everything, right? But now,
right,
there are free graphic design resources. There are free content resources. There are free HTML resources. whatever they are good at, you can find something.
In addition to having kittens and animated gifs, there's also like a wealth of knowledge about how to do web stuff.
Can we just call out the fact that you just said gifs, which is neither of the two accepted pronunciations?
Yes. That's the correct
way to say it. Sorry, I heard that and I had to go there.
At my kid's school, they have Chromebooks, and the Chromebooks they can use to do, like, you know, the Google Suite. I think they can do code.org. They can do a bunch of, like, intro-level technology things, and I'm pretty sure Chromebooks are in the low hundreds, brand new.
And you can teach the kid to hack it, put Linux on it, and make it into a real computer.
Both my kids only use Linux.
Oh, those poor saps. I say that, that's me going back in time, because I remember trying to work with Linux when I was a kid, and that was brutal.
It's changed so much. Like, it's, they sat down, my son got a Windows laptop from my dad, and he had a hard time using it.
Folks, that's what we got for you this week. I hope it was helpful. I hope it was fun. I know that this maybe wasn't as educational and useful and helpful as the Gutenberg episode, but I think that this topic is still an important one in its own way, which is why we wanted to tackle it now, especially on the heels of episode 7. Go back and listen to episode 7, Coding 9-5. That's the one where we talk about not so much the
far more contemporary.
Yeah, it's more now, and it's about how you get into web development, what you need to know to, you know, make money doing it, and we include a lot of resources for learning and getting better and stuff like that. So these two episodes dovetail well. So that's why we wanted to do it now and early, so we could.
And we'll be back to newer stuff next episode.
We've got some great guests lined up.
We got a guest, right?
Y'all like Jeff. It seemed like y'all enjoyed Jeff, so we said, you know what, maybe we should have somebody else on who is drinking less than us. I don't know.
This episode of the Drunken UX podcast is brought to you by Gasmark 8. Look, web hosting is not sexy. It's just something that's kind of there. You pay every month to the big hosting company that secretly owns all the smaller hosting companies, and you get slow speeds, oversold servers, and terrible support. But the reality is, the couple extra seconds it takes for your website to load could mean lost customers or clients. Less customers equals less money. Where do you go if you want super fast, reliable, and affordable web hosting and you don't really want to babysit a Linux server 24/7? Gasmark 8. Their hosting environment is built for speed and security. All SSD storage? Check. Blazing fast WordPress? Check. Free SSL certificates for all domains if you don't already have one? Check. Data centers on both US coasts, the UK, and mainland Europe? Yes, yes, yes. Gasmark 8 was started by an American, Mike Rychwalski, and a Brit, Adam Palin, two higher ed veterans who met at a conference and started a company making WordPress websites. As more clients complained about their web hosting, Mike and Adam thought over a couple of ciders at the pub that there's got to be a better way. So they built one, and now dozens of small businesses, developers, and nonprofits trust Gasmark 8 with hosting their websites. If you run a web development or creative agency, Gasmark 8 has a great reseller program you can use to upsell their fast and secure hosting to your clients. As a special for listeners of the Drunken UX podcast, Gasmark 8 is offering this limited time special. You can get all the features of their super fast platform for just $10 a month. Just go to gasmark8.com/drunk to sign up. That's gasmark8.com/drunk.
Thanks for everybody listening this week. This is, we had a good time talking about stuff, chalking about it.
I'm looking forward to folks making fun of my old website, frankly.
Yeah, no, nobody's finding my website.
I was on like 4 web rings. I'd won like 12 Star Trek awards. It was great.
That's amazing.
I will honestly say my Star Trek site was really good. For that point in time, it was a really good website. I was pretty proud of it. Well, and Paramount didn't sue me for copyright infringement, so I count that as a win as well. Hey, folks, if you want to follow the Drunken UX podcast, be sure to check us out. Twitter, Facebook, /DrunkenUX. Same thing with Slack, except we are at DrunkenUX.com/Slack. Come chat with us. Let us know how you feel. I also want to thank everybody who is listening. If you found out about us through the Smashing Magazine post, that was awesome.
Oh my god! Oh,
believe
that's
me,
so great.
I noticed. I saw the numbers. I know a lot of you are here because of that, so I want to give you guys a shout out, and I hope you are enjoying it. This is what we do. We know there's a lot of web development podcasts and a lot of different ways you can get this kind of information. We try to have a little bit of fun with it, and I've had a fair amount of vodka tonight, so hopefully you understand it all. I apologize if not, but
most episodes aren't nostalgic.
No. Yeah, this is a little bit off the beaten path. Yeah. We have some stuff coming up on web strategy, on web security is going to be a great discussion. In between that, there was something else, but I don't remember what it is.
The security one got Chris, right? Are you going to join us?
Yes. We have Chris coming up, Chris Wigman, who helped write the iThemes Better security plugin. Better WordPress security if you're older than that. Yeah. So that'll be fun. We've got Elena Waynes coming up from the Strategy Car podcast is going to join us.
Right. Oh, that's so cool.
So tons of stuff coming up. This is what we do, folks. This is why you're here. So
yeah, thanks for joining
us. We look forward to seeing you next time. On Monday, real-time overview will be coming up. Look forward to that. And with that, I'm gonna go to bed, guys.
Same.
Have fun. Take care. Enjoy. Keep your personas close.
Thanks.
And your users closer.